You are listening to Podcasters of Horror, a podcast about exploring horror anthologies from film and TV, as part of the Super Network, with your hosts, Super Marcy.
And he just gave off, like, very creepy vibes, so you're always very unsure of this guy.
And the terrible Australian, Beat Germine.
Which, in that version, it's a Krusty the Clown doll that's harassing Homer.
This podcast may contain coarse language.
It just kept getting weirder and weirder, and it's, what the f*** is up with this house?
Adult themes.
You know, she's only just a little girl, but he really is very mean to her.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. For more information, please visit supermarcy.com or see the show notes. To show your support, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Please enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 26 of Podcasters of Horror, the horror anthology-focused podcast that began with discussing every episode of Masters of Horror and continued with discussions of horror and horror-adjacent film and TV shows. I am one of your hosts, Super Marcy, and with this episode, we head back to the original The Twilight Zone series with featured discussions on three episodes, which are 22, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, and The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. I am joined by my regular co-host, Bede Germine. Hello, Bede. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing well. Very excited and happy to be back in the Twilight Zone. Had a lot of fun with the past episode we did, where we discussed, I think it was The Living Doll and Little Girl Lost.
Yes, it was. But before we go any further, Marcy, I have to do this because since we are talking about the Twilight Zone, I just got to do this. Do, 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 do. There we go. I mean, I had this, but that's the thing. It's like the X-Files theme, Marcy. When you say the Twilight Zone theme, you just automatically have to sing the theme music to the show.
Anyway.
I feel like if Bede's far enough off, you could potentially avoid a copyright strike, though. So, you know, it's win-win.
Exactly. But, Marcy, we're not alone on the show.
No, we are not alone. We are joined on this episode by a Super Network regular, but he is making his first appearance on Podcasters of Horror specifically. Please welcome Sam Inglis, who you may know as co-host of Fearless Pretender and Hawk Talk, which I believe when this is out, you'll be coming back soon with that.
We're definitely returning this year with more Hawk Talk. You know, we've had some complications and things like that. So, but we're definitely coming back this year in 2024. We've got some really exciting stuff, hopefully, lined up for that. But, you know, it's a show that takes a while to research and record. We're very, very serious about it, as we are about Fearless Pretender, of course. But yeah, it's so not sure when, but definitely this year.
Definitely this year. That's awesome. And my appearance hopefully on Fearless Pretender will be coming up February.
Yeah, February is the next episode. We just dropped, as we're recording this, we just dropped our January episode of Fearless Pretender, which for people who don't know is my podcast with my co-host Jason Sean on the films of Jennifer Jason Leigh. We're going in chronological order through her career. But this month, January 24, we've got the first of a sort of irregular mini-series that we're doing of films that she was almost in. So we're talking about what might have been and the films that actually are with Pretty Woman and an 80s teen movie called Just One of the Guys, both of which she was very much in the running for. But of course, next month in February, you're going to be joining us and we were discussing The Hitcher for that. So it's one of the big ones.
Yes, very excited for that one to drop as well. But yeah, let's get straight to it. And we are going to enter The Twilight Zone.
You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
First up for discussion is 22, which is episode 53 of the show, which lands it in season 2, episode 17. I'll get into plot synopsis and everything, and the information with some of this has been sourced from IMDb and Wikipedia. So while in hospital recovering from overwork, Liz Powell keeps dreaming about going down to the hospital morgue. The teleplay was by Rod Serling, based on an antidote from famous ghost stories by Bennett Cerf. It was directed by Jack Smite, and it stars Barbara Nichols, Jonathan Harris, Fred Wayne, Arlene Sachs, Mary Adams, and Norma Connelly. This one has been linked with Final Destination as perhaps being a potential inspiration. However, the screenwriter has said that he wasn't inspired by The Twilight Zone, hadn't watched the series. However, the final scene of 22 is essentially the setup for Final Destination, and we'll get into some of those similarities as we get into the discussion. Our opening narration for this episode. This is Miss Liz Powell. She's a professional dancer and she's in the hospital as a result of overwork and nervous fatigue. And at this moment, we have just finished walking with her in a nightmare. In a moment, she'll wake up and we'll remain at her side. The problem here is that both Miss Powell and you will reach a point where it might be difficult to decide which is reality and which is a nightmare, a problem uncommon perhaps, but rather peculiar to the Twilight Zone.
Room for one more, honey.
And so we'll get straight to discussion. I'll go first, then I'll hand it over to Sam and then Bede. So I picked this episode to discuss on the podcast as it is one that I have seen before. And to this day, it is an episode that has remained with me. I believe I first saw the episode like over 15 years ago as I had read an article about how an episode of The Twilight Zone could have inspired the movie Final Destination. It was something like that. So out of curiosity, I decided to check out the episode, and it's one that I felt was quite chilling from start to finish. I really liked that there was great atmosphere throughout that I felt, and it builds up with intensity through its first part, but then it kind of unleashes it all with the shocking conclusion towards the end. And the shocking conclusion is, you know, what made The Twilight Zone such a memorable show. And this shocking conclusion so far is probably one of my favorites. It's easy to see how a film could be inspired by the premise. A woman is plagued by nightmares, only to find out the nightmares are playing out in real life. And she runs away from boarding the plane she's meant to get on, but then that plane just blows up once in the air. It's a simple but haunting premise that, dare I say, Final Destination felt like it took that but expanded upon. And I almost felt there was a bit of Lucio Fulci's The Psychic here. Yeah, I was kind of thinking about the things repeating for Liz, which reminded me of the musical notes repeating in that film. There is a paranoia build-up, and we see and hear things that were part of the nightmare, part of the dream. I really liked the performance of Barbara Nichols as Liz Powell. And for some reason, I really enjoyed the weirdly creepy performance by Jonathan Harris as the Doctor. And I mean, he's best known for a lot of voice work, but perhaps best known as Dr. Smith in the original Lost in Space TV series. 22 is actually so far one of my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone. I just think it's excellent. And I have a feeling I might be in the minority of having a lot of love for this one, but we'll see. Over to Sam.
There's some good stuff here. I don't disagree that the performances are good. I think the opening sequence, the first walk down to the morgue, is really creepy. And, you know, then the reveal of the nurse who greets her at the morgue being upstairs is a really good little shock moment. And there's a sort of claustrophobia to the hospital room setting that is effective enough. I don't think it's a great episode. I think, honestly, it's a little stretched even for what it is. You know, even at 23 minutes, essentially, when you take out the opening and closing narration and things like that, even at that sort of running time, it's a bit of a stretched premise. There's only really that morgue sequence and the final shot that are anything more than build up in it. And, you know, it feels like you could deal with almost all of that in that setup and the build up. It feels like a shorter film to me. You know, a 10 minute version of it, I think, would be really tense and intense as well. I think the performances are good. Not knowing what had been said by, I think it was Glenn Morgan who wrote Final Destination, Morgan and Wong. Yes. So not knowing what had been said by them, I looked at it and I didn't see much connection to Final Destination other than that final shot, which is, you know, as you said, the jumping off point for Final Destination rather than the closing shot here. And that's the way to go if you're going to use something like that as as an inspiration. I think, you know, take the basic idea and expand on it. What this doesn't have, which Final Destination definitely does, is this sort of pervasive sense of doom. This idea of death as a kind of stalking force. And I think this episode is also a little short on character, but not a bad episode, but I think it's more interesting as inspiration than as an episode, potentially.
And Bede.
Yeah, well, this is my first time watching the episode, and I knew there was an episode that some had said that Final Destination would have been inspired by, because the plot's sounded very similar, and I didn't realize it was actually 22 until you suggested it for this episode, Marcy. So I was very kind of curious to sit down and watch it. So, but I guess knowing that it was going to have some elements that were similar to Final Destination, I kind of already knew at the back of my mind, like, where the story is going to go. But I will admit, for the first two halves, like, I thought, okay, this is really interesting in terms of where it's going within its story. And I do agree with both of you that the opening scene with our main character going down to the morgue, and then when she meets that nurse, that scene was genuinely creepy in how it was staged. And also, I think one of the things I was also kind of caught off by when I sat down to watch this episode as well is I didn't realize that this episode was shot on video. Because based on the information I've read in season two, to keep costs down, they actually shot six episodes on video rather than film. And this was one of them. And so I have to admit, I think having this episode shot on video definitely added to the eeriness to the episode, particularly with that opening nightmare sequence, because I think if it was actually done on film, I don't think it would have been as effective, or at least as eerie as it was.
I think you could argue that maybe a mix of media would be the most effective thing here. Have one side of it, either the reality or the dream, shot on film and the other shot on video, whichever you want. You know, it might be more interesting to shoot reality on video to give the dream world a more vivid idea. But obviously, if it's a budgetary reason, then, you know, those are those concerns. And I'm not denigrating anything for that. I didn't even know it was shot on video. If you're talking as an artist, idea, that's probably an interesting way to go about it.
I'm definitely thinking about it.
Oh, definitely. I did notice Jonathan Harris when he played the doctor. When I first saw him on screen, I'm thinking, why does he look very familiar? And then, of course, I found out, oh, it's Dr. Smith. And his performance is creepy in its own way, especially when every time he's around the character of Liz and how he smiles around her, and some of the offhanded things he says to her just came across as very creepy to me, even though at the same time you could definitely tell that there's a genuine care for him as a doctor. So it's kind of an interesting performance that he's playing with this character. And Barbara Nichols, I think, did a really good job. And I have to imagine that she had to have based her performance on Marilyn Monroe, because the way with her voice and also her appearance felt very Marilyn Monroe-esque in terms of how she played the character. Well, it's funny
you say that, because she did play a character in the Batman TV series, and I think the character's name was Marilyn. From what I like briefly saw, I think there was comparisons between those two actresses at the time, and they kind of referenced that a little bit.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
So you're kind of on the nose there with that one, just with your viewing without prior knowledge. I find that quite fascinating.
Oh, definitely. And going and after, once we get to the third act of the story, and that's when the sort of the final destination connection comes in. Like, it's a pretty still an effective last half, especially how it, since it is shot on video, again, some of these scenes do come across as more eerie in terms of how they're presented. But I think overall, as an episode, I think it's a pretty solid episode. Like, I don't think it's an amazing episode by any means, but I did enjoy it for what it is. But yeah, but I feel like at the same time, they could have done a little bit more with the concept. But granted, this is a 25-minute episode, and 5 minutes of those include opening and closing credits. Like, they can only do as much as they possibly can with this premise. But overall, I did enjoy it, even though they could have done more with it.
Yeah. And look, it's not easy to discuss this without speaking about Final Destination because of that, whether or not it's intentional or not. But, you know, when I first saw Final Destination, like, at least for me, it did kind of have like the Twilight Zone qualities of that weird bizarreness and shocking ending. So for me, the series itself feels like something that could have been born out of the Twilight Zone, or again with the X-Files. And we know that the premise started off for an X-Files episode, and things like that for me are kind of intrinsically linked in a way. But yeah, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say, yeah, of course it actually comes out of a series that you could say, certainly in its Monster of the Week episodes, which for me are almost always the strongest episodes. I'd never, certainly beyond like the third season, really warmed to the entirely convoluted mythology of the X-Files. But the Monster of the Week stuff is really good fun a lot of the time. And in those episodes, from what limited stuff I've seen, it seems very much like a successor to the Twilight Zone in a lot of ways. Obviously with an overarching narrative rather than the pure anthology. But what's interesting about Final Destination is that the more X-Files like it is, the weaker it is as a film. Like, easily the worst aspect of that movie, and for my money, it's, you know, second from bottom in the series ranking for me. It's not a bad movie, but it's one that was built on very effectively by three of its four sequels. Number four is terrible, but
that I can agree with.
But the weakest aspect of it is the FBI agent characters, who are like this ersatz Mulder and Scully, who are completely redundant, badly performed, and really slow the film down. And it's very interesting to me that we never see any characters like them again in the series, you know, which I think immediately makes all of the, you know, it is one of the things that really contributes to most of the other films being better than the original. Yeah, as I say, I like Final Destination well enough, but, you know, full disclosure, my favorite of the series is number three, which I know a lot of people don't like. And yes, part of it is the Mary Elizabeth Winstead factor, but it also has like the best deaths in the series, the most baroque deaths in the series, I think. And those feel like the raison d'etre of the Final Destination movies to me. It's like I barely watch them as narrative. At a certain point, I don't massively care about the characters. Like, there's this hilarious thing that everyone keeps telling Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and she keeps telling everyone how much of a control freak she is as a character, and it's just not in the character at all in the screenplay. They just keep saying it about her, but I don't care, because all of the really good death scenes in that it's like just a compilation at a certain point, and it's easily the best compilation of the series, I think. So yeah, it's almost an anti-narrative series, which is interesting. But yeah, I enjoy it for that. But yeah, I mean, I understand why people have more of a nostalgia for the first film, obviously, and it's definitely the most sort of traditionally narrative driven, and this, aside from two, the strongest in that respect. I get why people like it more than I do.
Bede, do you have any comments with Final Destination?
Well, I mean, the first film is still, in my opinion, the best one, mainly because it does focus more on story and on character compared to the other entries in the series. That, I mean, I like the series as much as the next person, but it is a series where they were like, oh, we can just do these great, unpredictable, gory set pieces. And that's what they kind of only start focusing on with the follow-up films. Like, I still enjoyed the sequels on that level, but to me, the first film is still the strongest all-round entry in the entire franchise because it goes for, like, yeah, it does an interesting job with the premise. And also, like, yeah, there are some great set pieces in this film. Like, even though, yeah, some of the set pieces and sequels afterwards would definitely be much more grander, much more over the top and much more gorier, which, you know, I love as well. But I think how it's sort of they're done in this film felt more believable and more chilling in how they're presented. And having Death more as this force in this first film was just more compelling to me. And, you know, yeah, it definitely has its cheesy elements as well. But I think overall, it's still a pretty great film as a whole. And kind of sort of the going with the X-Files type of aspect, well, it kind of makes sense because, like you already said, Marcy, like this was kind of written as almost like a spec episode for a X-Files episode by Jeffrey Riddick. But James Wong and his co-writing partner, Glenn Morgan, actually worked on the X-Files. So this was like their directorial, their first film together. So yeah, I mean, it makes sense that it has that sort of X-Files theme because its director and writers worked on the actual show and also delivered many of the show's best episodes, including the one that was actually banned from TV for a while, which was the episode Home. So it definitely has those elements there, but I still found the movie pretty compelling. And of course, like, even though I enjoyed the episode of 22 overall, but I think Final Destination kind of does a little bit more with that premise that I think that I personally, for me as a viewer, find compelling.
Yeah, like for me, like I really just love the episode and I can't quite put my finger on why. It just, for me, is very compelling. It's this just interesting little story. But I do like that Final Destination takes sort of this simple idea but adds like, you can't really cheat death. Death has your design. So I think that expansion with having the vision stuff really worked. I do have a kind of complicated relationship with the films. I think number two is the best one. And I think one is there behind it. And I would probably say 5-3, then 4. So I'm a little all over the place with it, but it is a series I want to properly rewatch. I think we're meant to be getting another one at some point.
Four's at the bottom, no ranking is entirely wrong.
Well, that's it. Four is not good. And I have a feeling rewatching it again, I'll probably warm up to three a bit more. Mm. Yeah.
And it's a delight.
And like, I know, like with the second movie in particular, because we're talking about that for a second, like one of the big scenes of that is, of course, the highway scene, which I think any of us, even if we drive a car,
it still gives me nightmares.
It does. Like whether we drive a car or a passenger, if we're behind a truck that has wood or other things behind it, first thing that pops into our head is Final Destination 2.
I was in a car with my friend David, and you know, I don't drive, so he was driving. We were behind a truck with like concrete paving slabs on it.
Oh.
And one fell off and nearly hit us. It was like so very close.
That's
to being
terrifying.
It was like, yeah, if we'd been going a little faster, if he'd been going a little slower,
Well, you better make sure things are not hitting you or falling down, or, you know, protect yourself just in case.
I'll definitely
very much out of that moment. You know, there's been some other interesting riffs on, you know, the idea of designs in terms of death and the afterlife and things like that, which, you know, may tie into other Twilight Zone episodes. I should say I have a bit of a drinking game on Fearless Pretender because Jason is really well read in TV and I watch almost no TV. So these are the first three episodes of the Twilight Zone I've ever seen. So if we're on Fearless Pretender, I would just say drink. You know, the other things that sort of come to mind in terms of like ideas of death and design have been like The Good Place recently and a Japanese show that I just finished watching called Brush Up Life, which has some interesting ideas about afterlife and repeating your lifespan. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting ways to go with this sort of design aspect that I think is really cool. You can go a lot of ways with it.
Absolutely. We'll wrap up our discussion and we'll give ratings. My rating for this is a 4.5 visions of the morgue out of 5. I just can't explain it. Something about this episode just hits me hard. Sam?
I think I would go with the same grade that I go with now for Final Destination, which is a 2.5. Both of them have some good ideas. Final Destination develops them more, but has been outclassed. This one doesn't have the time or you know, to really develop its ideas. And, you know, its best moment is its, you know, closing image. So they both have their virtues and their flaws.
And Beat?
I give it about 3.5 overall. And like, it's a pretty solid episode. It does have some pretty creepy moments and solid performances. And what this episode and also Final Destination, why it's, I get another reason why it's still my favorite entry in the franchise and still the best one, is because out of all the, any scene of any of that, all those films, and the plane crash is still the thing that terrifies me the most, because I'm a nervous flyer, so the idea of a plane crashing is fucking scary as shit to me, more than anything else. So, and seeing that kind of image again at the end of this episode is like, oh yeah, I'm glad I'm not on that plane right now. But anyways, though.
Anyways. Yes. And in my best not Rod Serling voice, our closing narration for the episode. Miss Elizabeth Powell, professional dancer. Hospital diagnosis, acute anxiety brought on by overwork and fatigue. Prognosis, with rest and care, she'll probably recover. But the cure to some nightmares is not to be found in known medical journals. You look for it under potions for bad dreams, to be found in The Twilight Zone. And our next episode for this podcast is 5 Characters in Search of an Exit. This was episode 79, which puts it at season 3, episode 14. Plot synopsis. An army major awakens in a small room with no idea of who he is or how he got there. He finds 4 other people in the same room, and they all begin to question how they each arrived there, and more importantly, how to escape. Written by Rod Serling, based on The Depository by Marvin Petal, directed by Lamont Johnson, starring William Wyndham, Murray Matheson, Susan Harrison, Kelton Garwood, and Clark Allen. Now, in the sort of looking up and trying to find things, there have been similarities to it potentially having inspired something like Cube. The plot is kind of similar, where you have strangers kind of waking up in a cube, and here it's just in a strange room. No idea how they got there. Again, it's something that's shorter, so a movie expands upon that. Vincenzo Natali, who did Cube, has not confirmed either or, but this one also has some similarities with Toy Story, and I found that hadn't been really brought up and much in discussion, so we'll definitely be getting to that. Our opening narration for this episode: clown, hobo, ballet dancer, bagpiper, and an army major, a collection of question marks. 5 improbable entities stuck together into a pit of darkness. No logic, no reason, no explanation. Just a prolonged nightmare in which fear, loneliness, and the unexplainable walk hand in hand through the shadows. In a moment, we'll start collecting clues as to the whys, the whats, and the wheres. We will not end the nightmare. We'll only explain it because this is the Twilight Zone.
What's going on here? Where are we? What are we? Who are we?
Over to you, Sam, with your thoughts.
Yeah, this was my pick of the episodes that Marcy presented us. And as I said, I've never seen any Twilight Zone before. So I picked it largely because, you know, the premise sounded interesting. And because choosing it would give me an excuse to revisit Cube, which I hadn't seen for about 15 years. And we'll talk about how that went in a bit. Maybe you can guess. My first thought on this was, yeah, this is hell. Someone's playing the bagpipes. But that aside, I assume we're spoiling what's going on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So to get into what I actually want to talk about this episode, we have to spoil it from the beginning. Mm. And what it turns out is that each of these characters, these archetypal figures, none of them really develops a great like individual personality. They are all these archetypes. And it turns out that they're all dolls who are inside a donation box at, I think, like a Christmas fair of some sort.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, kind of fit. I think I watched this like 3 days after Christmas or so for this episode. So, you know, it felt sort of a very cold sort of festive. And that was kind of my feeling about it. The whole thing has this incredible icy coldness to it, just as a concept, once you know what's going on. But even before you do, because it is just this cube has a lot of design elements. You know, you can, they never do this in the film, but you can start looking at the walls and see if somewhere in the designs on the walls is a map or anything like that. You start wondering about that, and each room is different colors and things like that. This of course is in black and white, but it is just a gray cylindrical wall. And when you see that, it's, you know, completely featureless. It's not giving you any clues. It's not offering you any way to climb. So it is just this very claustrophobic, very impossible prison space or purgatory space. I often find myself looking at narratives like this that take place in a sort of sealed, confined world as some sort of commentary on the idea of purgatory. I think you can definitely take Cube that way as well. Mm. You know, so there are interesting ideas in that. But once we know the premise, what you said, Marcy, it strikes me as really a colder take on Toy Story 3 specifically. Because Toy Story 3 is about endings, essentially, and new beginnings, but mostly about endings. It's about the kid that the toys grew up with growing up and no longer needing them and passing them on to somebody else. And in Toy Story 3, that's ultimately a kind of joyous thing. And the toys are still who they are. In Five Characters, what's interesting is that they have no memory. They appear not to know who they are beyond this featureless room. And it's almost as if the act of an owner getting rid of those toys wipes their memory. And it's like this hellish idea once you know that, you know, this, yeah, very cold idea. And again, I think you look into ideas of purgatory and of hell and things like that. I don't think that necessarily goes away with the ending. I think there's some really interesting stuff going on.
Beach.
Well, this one in particular, I've heard for quite a while, because the title Five Characters in Search of an Exit is one of those titles, like, even though you've never seen every episode of The Twilight Zone, it's one of those titles that sticks out because it's that memorable of a title. And I've heard it on and off every now and again throughout the years, whether something like Cube or other films similar to it that have that kind of similar premise. But I have to be honest, though, when I sat down to watch this episode, I had a bit of an idea what the episode was going to be, just based on everything I've heard about it, you know, offhandedly. So when I sat down to watch the episode, it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. Because, like, once we meet the Major, I thought, okay, He's waking up, he's in a corner, and then we're introduced to the clown. I'm like, okay, this is not what I was expecting at all, was a clown character to be in it. Then, of course, we are introduced to the ballet dancer, the hobo, and the bagpipe, and I'm like, okay, this is definitely not what I was expecting at all. And I have to say, though, I still found it a pretty compelling episode overall. I think the performances are all very strong. And I do agree with Sam, there is that kind of coldness to the whole endeavor, which I did notice right away when the episode started. But where it goes in the end, when it offers that twist, it makes total sense why most of these characters outside of the major feel very cold and detached, particularly the ballet dancer. And I will admit, though, I must have heard about this twist somewhere in my travels over the years, because I think I remembered there was an episode of The Twilight Zone where the twist was the main characters discover they're actually dolls and they're not aware of it. And I just assumed that was a completely different episode compared to this one, until about maybe towards the last maybe couple of minutes of the episode, and then it kind of clicked into me. So it was kind of a weird kind of thing watching this episode. But overall, I think it's a pretty compelling one. It's a very well-written episode. It's well-directed. And what I find interesting as well, because Lamont Johnson, who directed this episode, he directed an episode of the TV show Felicity that is inspired by this episode.
No shit.
Yeah. And
I've heard of Felicity. I haven't seen any. I want to, because Kerry Russell.
Yes.
But how the fuck is there an episode of Felicity inspired by this?
Yeah, given what I've heard about that show.
I think it's like an episode that pays homage to it, but I think it's kind of like what they call a bottle episode, I believe, which is essentially just a one-off kind of episode. I mean, I only know off by hand because, again, they had an episode that paid homage to this episode, but reading up on it, it was directed by the same director of this episode. So it kind of is kind of funny that I think they actually purposely got him to come in to do the episode since he directed the original.
I'm actually rewatching The Americans at the moment, but just because of that, the next show I'm going to watch is Felicity. Like,
I used to love that show. I don't remember any of this, so I feel like I might need to have a look at this episode.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watched the odd episodes here and there back when it aired, but I think pretty much like in this day and age, it was the show that is best remembered with Kerry Russell cutting her hair during one of the seasons, and the entire world lost its mind.
It really did.
But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty solid episode, and it has a very effective twist. The performances are great, but I think when I was reading your notes, Marcy, and I totally agree with this, the standout performance to me was, of course, now I'm looking at the Felicity page and not the other one. So Murray Matheson, who played the clown, that was the standout performance to me, because I thought he was terrific. And based on, I'm now looking up on him, he's actually an Australian actor.
No way.
Yeah, he's a US-based Australian actor.
Oh, very cool.
So there you go.
So over to me.
Yes.
Yeah, I found this was like quite a cool, mysterious episode. The five strange people in a weird room together, no memory, no clue where they are, why they're there, who they are. The weird room just gives nothing away. What is it? And as you've said, it feels very cold. Like you've both said, it has this coldness. And knowing what it was, if this was in color, it would still feel quite cold, because that like donation bin thing would have been like just a sad gray. But, you know, as I was watching the episode, I was sure they were just like toys being played with inside like a shoebox. But as it turns out, I was kind of half right. They weren't being played with, but they were toys in the donation bin. And I found like, you know, and this kind of, I think, leads into what you said, Sam, that perhaps when the toys are donated, it wipes. That's where they get the memory wipe to make new memories with the new person. But, you know, each character, as you meet them, they're very strange. Like the ballerina played by Susan Harrison was so weirdly cold. And by the end, yeah, it makes sense. But I just thought she played that so perfectly. I really liked William Wyndham as the major. And I think he played that frustration of the situation very well. And the lack of understanding and why the others don't seem to be as worked up as he is, it makes sense in the grand scheme of things because they've been there longer, whereas you'd imagine the Major was probably just like donated into the bin. And yeah, as Bede said in my notes, Murray Matheson as the clown was the standout for me with this episode. I felt like this, he just had these creepy vibes for no reason and it worked. I mean, clowns in general can kind of be a bit unsettling and his really was. But I enjoyed this episode a lot. And it's so easy to see how the concept of random strangers being stuck in a room could inspire other things, as we mentioned Cube, but also how toys being alive, a Toy Story type thing. And as you said, Sam, especially like with three, with the sort of passing on toys. And this is kind of that idea, I think, as well. But yeah, let's get into a bit of Cube. Sam, you rewatched Cube with this. So how does Cube hold up after 15 years of not having rewatched it?
Like milk left in the sun, Marcy.
Oh dear.
Yeah, no, I'd only seen Cube once before. Looking again at it, I can see very basic inspiration here, but really only as a locked room drama. You know, it's not anything particularly specific. As I say, there is a little bit of sort of the idea of trying to escape in five characters, but it doesn't really become a driving force of anything, time as much as anything, I suspect. But also there are no indicators of how you might do it. It's, whereas Cube, right from the beginning, has the moving doors and all of that, and is clearly like a puzzle in order for the characters to try and get out. It's got a really great premise. It's got some interesting use, particularly of its set, which is they shot it in a single cube but relit to give different looks, which is very cleverly done. And obviously Natalie makes great use of a small budget in that respect. I don't love the rest of the look of it. There's a lot of, you know, sort of close-ups on wide angle lenses, which like feel really uncomfortable. I think that's partly what he's trying to do, but it just doesn't look very pleasing to me. The technical points aside, though, I'm amazed how well-received it was at the time. With the exception of Nicole DeBoer, who I think's pretty good, the rest of the cast, I think, are broad at best and awful at worst. The other lead, Maurice Dean Wint, who plays the guy who, you know, sort of starts off as the practical one but ends up going crazy, is like gurning into the camera throughout and growling, you know, every single line of his dialogue. I just thought he was awful in it. And complicated maths aside, which honestly actually doesn't end up, excuse the pun, adding up to much, I just think it's very predictable. I think if you think about it in terms of, you know, the initial setup, you kind of know exactly where things are going to end up. And you will get to like things like the meanings of the noises from outside long before the characters do. I found it quite frustrating, and actually, as I said, not particularly related to this film, to this episode. I was thinking, as I said, much more of Toy Story 3 for this, and I would recommend this film, this episode, and Toy Story 3 as a pairing. You know, I think there would be a really interesting double bill. I don't know that there's actually much to glean from watching Cube along with this.
And I think that's what makes the conversations with these episodes and what people have said, oh, this could have inspired this. I think it's interesting to break it down and give a perspective to be like, yes, no, maybe this little bit did. But I mean, you could argue the setup for Saw could have been based on this. It's two people stuck in a room, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's things that have been done many times. And I think perhaps why Cube, it's that sort of the same room, the same thing. I mean, it's different when you change, but it's kind of that sense of five unknown people in this one particular thing. So
I think, you know, Saw was probably jumping off Cube in some ways as well. You know, because the timeline works for that.
Yeah, look, like you, I haven't seen Cube for like 15 or something years. I did watch a few bits and pieces of it. I do plan to have a proper rewatch because I am curious to see how I feel about it now, especially after your rewatch, to see how my feelings change on the film. But I remember at the time enjoying that concept, enjoying this weird feel of it. And again, like the cube, it was just the one like set, but relit in and stuff in different ways. And let me tell you, that is way more effective than whatever the fuck Bruno Mattei was doing in his movies to do that. But I give them credit. It you know, from the little scenes and stuff that I watched recently, like, yeah, that's really good. So I do want to rewatch Cube, see how I feel about it as a whole.
I'm interested to see. Sam. There was a recent remake. I think it was either Korean or Japanese.
Yes.
I think it was Japanese. Yeah.
Yes, from 2021, I believe. I do actually want to double bill Cube with this remake when I do the watch. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested to see that and see, you know, if they've made any changes, particularly stylistically. So, yeah, be interesting.
Beat.
Well, it has been a little while since I've seen Cube, but, you know, only by maybe a couple of years and all that. But I'm a big fan of that film. I think it was pretty... Well, that's the thing. Like, I have to always go to... And we have to remember as well, like, being that it was a very low-budget film. Like, even though, yeah, on a technical level, it'll definitely deliver, like, it's sure some aspects of it definitely probably won't work because it was a debut feature working with a very tight, small budget. So not everything is going to be 100% perfect, whether it be from a writing, performance, or technical standpoint. But I think regardless of even if the performances, from what I remember, were a bit of a mixed bag, I still found the story still pretty compelling. And also, well, I guess... For me, it was unpredictable. Like, I was curious about where this story was going to go. And also the inventiveness that Vincenzo Natali brought to this film. Like, the fact that it was basically just one room with them just changing lights. And so it could look like it was a different, like, room that the characters were going into. It, like, stuff like that is very inventive. And, of course, being with, as a filmmaker... You're going to be doing a lot of very stylized things that even if it is off-putting at first, it's the first filmmaker kind of, you know, well, they're still trying to figure it out and stuff like that. So, but overall, it is a pretty compelling film. Like, again, like, I think both this episode and this film, like, they do have that kind of concept, but they do kind of tackle it in very different ways. Being one is more of a horror sci-fi film and the other one is more of like this kind of existential character study. And that I think in their own separate ways they're both effective. And I would say compared to 22 and Final Destination, I think both this episode and Cube, the film, actually do pretty well with how they tackle this type of premise for their stories.
So what do you think to the other suggested pairing of Toy Story 3?
I think that's an interesting kind of pairing as well, especially with the toy aspect, because Toy Story was definitely on my mind when I was watching this episode, particularly when you find out more that these are dolls. And I would say that's a pretty good pairing as well. And it, like you say, Sam, if I had to pair it with any of the Toy Story films, it probably would be the third film, because there's a lot more of that existential stuff in that film compared to the other entries, even though they do.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, and as when I read the closing narration, we'll get a little bit more of how the ending kind of does tie into Toy Story 3's ultimate ending as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we'll get straight to our final thoughts and ratings on Five Characters in Search of an Exit. Sam?
It's hard for me to rate these because I don't have a comparison point really for the Twilight Zone. These are the first... As I say, these are the first episodes I've seen. But just on its own as like a piece of drama, at least a 4. I think this is really strong. There's like visually it's really intriguing while also being incredibly minimalist. I think the existential ideas are really interesting and it's well acted throughout. Yeah, I would go with a 4 for this and like a 1.5 for Cube at this point. And a 5 for Toy Story 3.
Oh, absolutely. Toy Story 3 is wonderful. Indeed.
Yeah, I think I'd give this episode a 4 as well. And by contrast, I give Cube a 4 as well. So, yeah, I think it's a really compelling episode. And again, it's kind of even though the Twilight Zone is very well known for contributing so many well-known sci-fi and horror themed premises. But this one in particular, kind of seeing a one that's not, it's kind of hard to describe what to call this episode, what kind of genre it fits in. Because to me, like I said before, it feels more like an existential character study more than anything else. But I think overall, it's just a great episode. And definitely, it was not what I expected, but I sat down to watch it, but it still ended up being a rewarding one by the end of it.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement with this one. My rating is for am I real or am I a toy out of 5. I really enjoyed this one. And as I said, I kind of thought I knew where it was going, but was, again, still surprised because I wasn't quite there. But it does have this interesting, like, philosophical approach with how the characters end up talking to each other and the way they ponder, is this purgatory, is this hell? It's very intriguing and it's very deep for, you know, a 25-minute episode of, at this point, I guess it was early 60s TV. But yeah, definitely worth a watch, you know, a rewatch, a watch, in my opinion. And yeah, our closing narration for this episode, just a barrel. A dark depository where are kept the counterfeit make-believe pieces of plaster and cloth, wrought in a distorted image of human life. But this added hopeful note, perhaps they are unloved only for the moment. In the arms of children, there can be nothing but love. A clown, a tramp, a bagpipe player, a ballet dancer, and a major. Tonight's cast of players on the odd stage known as the Twilight Zone. Yeah, with that closing narration, with that offering of hope for these characters being brought to new children to be loved, is very much what that ending of Toy Story 3 is. So I think that's right on the money as a double with that. And for the final episode of discussion for this evening, the monsters are due on Maple Street. This was the 22nd episode of the show, placing it in season 1, episode 22. Our plot synopsis. On a peaceful suburban street, strange occurrences and mysterious people stoke the residents' paranoia to a disastrous intensity. Written by Rod Serling. Directed by Ronald Winston. Starring Claude Atkins, Barry Atwater, Jack Weston, Burt Metcalf, Amesy Strickland, Anne Barton, Jan Hanslick, and Mary Gregory. This potentially inspired The Mist, both as the story by Stephen King and the film from Frank Darabont. Darabont has allegedly said the episode was an inspiration, and that was quoted in a Collider article. Our opening narration for this episode. Maple Street, USA, late summer, a tree-lined little world of front porch gliders, barbecues, the laughter of children, and the bell of an ice cream vendor. At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:43 p.m. on Maple Street. This is Maple Street on a late Saturday afternoon. Maple Street in the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came.
Mr. Brand, you better not.
Why not?
They don't want you to.
Beat, take it away with your thoughts.
Well, this is actually my second time seeing this episode. This was one of the earliest Twilight Zone episodes I've seen. I remember watching this because back in the when I was younger, I went to the video shop and they actually had some of the episodes of the Twilight Zone on VHS. But of course, back in that time, they'd only pair like say 2 episodes rather than say a whole season. So this was one of the episodes that was on that video that I rented. With The Twilight Zone, it was one of those shows I had heard about, but I'd never seen. So I thought, okay, finally check this show out and see what it's like. And yeah, the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is one that has stuck with me since that viewing. I think it's a truly great episode. And this is when I think of The Twilight Zone, this is one of the episodes that, at least that I'd seen so far, that still stands out to me as one of the best that I've seen. I think it's a pretty compelling episode overall. The performances are all equally great, and I love the sense of paranoia and escalation that it has throughout. And of course, at the time, the twist did caught me off guard when I watched it for the first time, but it actually makes sense within the story that it's telling. But also, it's definitely an episode like that has a lasting big impact in not just for the series, but also in pop culture. Like you say, this episode, of course, was a big inspiration for both the original short story and film versions of The Mist. But this story has been kind of inspired a lot of different types of media. And this episode, of course, being so famous that the 2000s revival of The Twilight Zone actually did a remake of this episode, but did it in an interesting context in a post 9/11 world. So, and also another thing I think what really adds to this episode is, of course, the time that it made it, because you got to remember this is a time when the Cold War was going on, and also this is when McCarthyism was also going on. So you could definitely tell that this episode was definitely written as a response to both those elements. And I think it's just a really excellent episode. Like I said, it's so brilliantly well written. And like, yeah, there's definitely frustrations with the episode, not because of anything on a technical performance or writing level. It's just how these characters react in this situation. You kind of want to be there and to say, to snap out of it and give them a good old slap to kind of get out of their paranoia. But that's what is great about this episode. It gets you invested with its story. And yeah, to me, at least of the ones I've seen from the series so far, I think it's just an excellent episode all round.
Yeah, the monsters that you're on Maple Street is a heck of an episode. The amount of suspense that is built up in 20 minutes couldn't have been cut by the sharpest blade. The group of town folk, like, they're without power, they're confused, and there's like some mysterious thing that flew overhead, and you know, it pretty soon they begin to suspect each other of being a monster or an alien. And we've got a young character of Tommy who sort of tells the plot of like his sci-fi and comics and movies that he reads and watches, and you know, the townsfolk kind of scrub it off, but then they don't, but they all start to suspect each other. So any little move someone does, it puts them under suspicion. And you know, someone accidentally gets shot, but all of this just worsens the situation, that they're pretty much going to destroy themselves out of this basic paranoia. That the ending, with that kind of being the point, I think is quite powerful. And it's stating that without the basics, humans just turn on each other. And we kind of know that's true. We've seen it. I really enjoyed everything about this one. The performances were great. The script managed to fit a lot in with such a short time frame. And it's quite clever. And I noticed there's certain bits of dialogue that might be a little repetitive at times. And I think that is meant to give you, the viewer, paranoia about these characters itself. It certainly moved up, now that I've seen it, to being one of my favorite episodes I've seen. And I can certainly see and appreciate how this could have inspired The Mist. And I think with this is very dire, not a positive or uplifting ending, I think that really leads into what Frank Darabont did with The Mist. Whether that plays a factor, I don't know. That's how I kind of saw it as I was watching it. Sam, your thoughts?
I mean, you guys have said a lot of it, to be honest, including, you know, Bede laying out the background there. I think this is a great episode as well. The only quibble I might have is I think it probably would be... How long was the remake series? Were they hour episodes?
I'm not exactly sure. I'll have to look it up.
I can't remember. Yeah, I'll try.
Just because, and it doesn't matter, but just because I think this would be a more effective hour-long drama than it is a 20-minute one, because you would have just a bit more time to develop the paranoia before things explode, you know? It is very instant just because of the time compression here. And that's my only real quibble with it. Performances are excellent. You buy into it all. And of course, you know, that is a little mitigated by the fact that it's so clearly all allegorical. you know, the descriptions of aliens who look like human beings being sent ahead to blend in is, as Bede was saying, it's a mainstay of like 50s paranoid sci-fi. It's at this time very much an allegory for fears about communists growing within American society. Again, it's really interesting that I'm rewatching The Americans at the moment. The way it's described here as a broad concept by Tommy may owe a lot to, and also have given a lot to, iterations of the likes of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Thing, The Stepford Wives, you know, those kinds of things came to mind for me even after I had watched it, because this was a first time watch in this case, that more readily than The Mist. I've got to say, it's a very effective piece of human drama, you know, a cautionary tale about the idea of a tiny seed of paranoia growing and destroying the sense and even the fact of community. And obviously that was an allegory for communism in the 50s, but, you know, as Bede was saying, again, it's been applied to a wide range of issues since and could still be applied to a wide range of different issues. I suspect if this were being remade today, it would come with a heavy dose of commentary on paranoia around immigration and potentially being decried by the right as woke propaganda because of that. But I could equally see the right co-opting it dishonestly as a commentary on trans and other identity politics issues. You know, I think you could make a really evil version of this episode if you're from the Daily Wire, for example. Yeah,
well, you know, they wouldn't do it very well if just trailers of the trash they've put out are anything to go by. But yes,
well, I've seen
see your
trailers. I've seen Run, Hide, Fight. It's despicably bad as well as just being despicable. But, you know, I think it's such a sort of universal idea and such an idea in which you can fit the concerns of the day so readily that it is easy to co-opt from that side as well. So I would hate it to be done, but in a way I think it would be really fascinating to see what bad actors would do with this premise, you know?
Indeed, definitely something to think about with that. Now, we've mentioned kind of like the research, The Mist came up a lot with this episode, so that's what we'll kind of discuss a little bit. And as The Mist is a film that we're going to have a proper deep dive in on a future episode of The King Zone, I guess for me personally, I won't go too much into my feelings on it, but we'll certainly have a little bit of a discussion and sort of if it relates or not. Bede.
Yeah, I can definitely see the inspiration, of course, especially in hindsight with The Mist. Like, I have rewatched The Mist recently because we are going to be doing an episode on it for The King Zone. So like you, I won't put too much into my thoughts on the film overall since we're going to do a deep dive in it. But I think it is still pretty, I think the film The Mist is still pretty effective. Like, it does, like, now kind of rewatched it recently, I could definitely see a lot of clunkiness in The Mist, particularly with how it kind of explores its themes. Like, it's still pretty effective at what it does. But I think at the same time, though, even though it can be quite effective, it can also be not quite as good. It's not as great as it once was, but I think at the same time, though, I know also that Frank Darabont has said that he used B sci-fi movies as an inspiration. So in a way, it's like he's having like this big weighty thematic themes within The Mist, but at the same time he's also paying homage to the B sci-fi films of the 50s and 60s. So it's kind of a weird kind of tonal shift between the two of them, which does make the film interesting and still compelling. And I mean, there are a lot of great things about that film that I do still very much enjoy. But that being said, though, like watching it again recently, yeah, it is very clunky. But I have a feeling that even though I haven't read the original short story, I have a feeling like given like Stephen King, as much as I do love him, he's not the most subtlest of writer. And I think it's probably also in the original short story as well. And you know, Frank Darabont just faithfully reinterpreted that for his film version.
Yeah, so like I said, I won't get too much into it. Look, for me, The Mist is a little bit of a mixed bag at times, and I'll certainly get into that on the future podcast where we will discuss it in more depth. For me, the strongest parts are when they're in that sort of the one confined area and everybody's kind of going off of each other. It's this unknown kind of situation. That's where I think its strengths are, and that's where I think the sort of the monsters are due is sort of ties into that especially. And when we get the character, I can't remember the character's name, the Marsha Gay Harden character.
Oh, yeah, Mrs. Carmody.
Yes, the very despicable character, maybe a little over the top or a lot over the top. It depends what you're going for, what you like. I think that kind of sort of leans into this a lot. And I think for me personally, because The Mist is a very heavy movie, I would have preferred not to have actually seen the monsters, but again, that's something I'll get into. And as Sam said, you hadn't seen The Mist before this, so you feel free to go as in-depth as you like for this.
Yeah, I don't think you're having me on that episode, so it's fine. but yeah, what I would say, this was a first watch of The Mist for me. And again, like the other two that we've talked about, if it was inspired by The Monsters of Dune, I think then it's a loose inspiration at best. I think the 50s Reds Under the Bed sci-fi that I was talking about is probably more apt pairing with this, though I don't know exactly the chronology of some of those things, but, you know, and what feeds into what. But I also think The Monsters of Dune is a vastly better version of the story than The Mist. The Mist is only good until we find out what's in The Mist. And after that, I think it's pretty poor. You know, the monsters are silly looking and unneeded. And thanks to the vintage of the film, the CGI is very rubbery. You know, the two things just... And actually, it's like, I don't like the designs of the monsters either. Like, some of them are... like weirdly cute for what they are. It's like it doesn't fit. Like I don't like the design at all.
So Sam, that's how they get you to come closer to them, so they can kill you.
Then the Mist thing is a whole bizarre misdirection on their part. But the thing is, the Monsters of Dune, for all that I think it, you know, it would be more effective at 40 minutes than 20. What it does is it deals briskly with all of the same themes that The Mist really drags out and repeats over and over again during the monotonous scenes in the store, particularly after we find out, you know, the monsters. Like the paranoia of it at the beginning is quite interesting, but once we get into them having been trapped for a long time, and particularly Mrs. Carmody, it's like the same scene over and over again. And that goes double for Stephen King's favored theme of making his villains fundamentalist Christians. And it's not that I disagree. Like, I could probably fairly describe myself as not just atheist, but anti-theist. But King's writing of these characters, it's just painfully repetitive. It's as if he doesn't trust us to get that he thinks fundamentalism is bad, and he thinks that writing the same character just once more might finally do the trick. In my capsule review, I said that I think The Mist might well work better as an episode of an anthology series, and I feel like The Monsters of Dune on Maple Street proves that point.
Interesting. I am curious to kind of read the Mist short story. I don't know if that's going to be part of King's Own's book club or not, but we'll see. Maybe I'll just read it for myself. Who knows? We'll go over our just final thoughts and rating. Bede, over to you.
I give this one 5 stars. Like, I think it's a great, great episode. Definitely my favorite of the ones we have seen so far. And it's also one that has left quite a lasting impact on me as a viewer, and I think it's just so brilliantly done. And there's a reason why this episode has still been, in a way, in the public consciousness when it comes to all things Twilight Zone, and a reason why they would want to do a remake of this episode for one of the other revivals. And based on what I've read about the revival from the 2000s, it's also a short series, so they were 22-minute episodes, so this was also pretty much like, I would imagine, just basically exactly the same with little bit of updating and stuff like that, and also changing a few things around. Although I'm surprised that Debbie Allen is the director of this episode, but That being said, this episode, it's fantastic. I love it. And it's definitely one of the must-see episodes of the whole series so far.
My rating is 4.5. Do They Suspect Me? Out of 5. Again, I think it's one of my favorite episodes I've seen of The Twilight Zone. It's just very well done across the board. And I think it's just a very smart, like, way of putting in how this paranoia and things can so easily destroy people. And we've had a rough few years on this planet, and we see that so much every freaking day. And this just kind of explains humans just so well. And yeah, like, seriously, watch this episode. It's fantastic. And side note about that 2000s revival of The Twilight Zone, I did used to watch that on TV. It was on quite late, if I remember. I distinctly remember Forrest Whitaker was the host. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if I have seen the remake episode of this one, but I'm kind of curious to check it out. And again, like Sam said, this could benefit from a longer runtime. So I am curious to see how a 2000s post 9/11 version works with that same shorter time frame. So I'm gonna have to give it a watch. Bede, did you have something to add?
I was gonna say, I think I did watch the revival, like at least the odd episode here and there. The only episode I really remember was there is an episode with Katherine Heigl that was about her playing a character who was sent back in time to kill Hitler as a child. And that was one of the episodes from what I remember.
That sounds insane. Sam, your rating and final thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, again, this is at least a 4. I think 5 characters in Search for an Exit was my favorite of this lot. But yeah, this is not far behind at all. It's very, very good. Very, very interesting. And honestly, a really good jumping off point for a lot of films better than The Mist, which for the record, I went with 2 stars on that. But half of one of those stars is purely for Andre Braugher's performance. May he rest in peace. You know, he's great and easily the best thing about it. And yeah, not in it enough. But yeah, there's a lot of good to be said about this. And from this whole thing, I'll definitely be watching more Twilight Zone, because a friend of mine a while ago sent me a massive box of like hundreds of copied DVDs that he had just backed up over the years and was trying to sort of clear out for space reasons. And he just sent them to me, this box of like 400 discs, maybe. And the entire Twilight Zone series was in that box. I have an excuse to get to those now.
Yeah, definitely. Like I'm sort of, part of the reason to do this is to have these discussions, but also watch more Twilight Zone. Personally, I feel it's a show that I want to see more episodes of. So it's an excuse to do it, but it's also motivating me to do it as well. Our closing narration, which I think I find one of the more interesting closing narrations for the show. The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout of its own. For the children and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that all these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone. And that wraps up this episode. And I think we had 3 really interesting episodes to discuss, as well as what films they could have potentially inspired. And I look forward to checking out more of the classic Twilight Zone series, which we'll probably do in a few months' time on the podcast. And we do have some other horror anthology things we'll be getting to with Podcasters of Horror in 2024. So with that wrapped up, you can find Podcasters of Horror at supermarcy.com. And you can find, if you look up Podcasters of Horror or the Super Network, you can find the podcast feeds. And of course, you can find the Super Network on your socials and me personally. I'm Super Marcy on everything. And Letterboxd, it is Super_Marcy as well. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast. And Bede, where can people find you?
Well, people want to find me personally. They can find me on both Twitter and Blue Sky under Bede Jemine. And they can also find me on Letterboxd under Bede Jemine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com and also listen to my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, and its spinoff show, Bede and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed. And you can look up for both those shows on the official social media accounts for them on both Twitter and Blue Sky under Bede vs TLD, and on Facebook and under Bede versus the Living Dead.
Yes. And Sam, where can people find you and your stuff?
Yeah, you can find me. I mean, I don't use it, but I'm still on Twitter ostensibly. I'm also on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. All of those are at 24FPS UK. And you'll find me talking about Fearless Pretender there, about Hawk Talk when that comes back. And increasingly, and perhaps to people's disappointment, you'll be finding me on shows for the Super Network, as it turns out.
Yes, Sam, I believe you'll be next on the Super Network with an upcoming episode of the Ozploit cast that I believe will be the March episode. So that's one to look forward to. And of course, the three of us will be on After Dark with Super Marcy in the near future as well. So we'll be definitely podcasting a bit together, and it is always a lot of fun. So thank you, Sam, for joining us. And of course, thank you, Bede, and thank you, me, for all of that. And yeah, look forward to more Podcasters of Horror this year. So until next time, be careful, you might be in the Twilight Zone. Bye-bye, everybody.